From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Anthony Shadid talks about his experiences covering the war in Lebanon and analyzes how the war has affected the region. Shadid is a Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the war in Iraq. He says Lebanon was even more dangerous than covering the invasion of Iraq. The 1944 movie Double Indemnity, starring Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray, has been released on digitally remastered DVD. Our critic at large, John Powers, considers it a perfect example of film noir. He'll tell us why. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Anthony Shadid, just returned to the U.S. from covering the war in Lebanon. He's a Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post and won a Pulitzer Prize in 2004 for his coverage of the war in Iraq. The award citation praised, quote, his extraordinary ability to capture at personal peril the voices and emotions of Iraqis as their country was invaded, unquote. As we'll hear, he faced plenty of personal peril in Lebanon. How did you get around to cover the war when so many of the roads were bombed out, the bridges were bombed, and people on the road were sometimes being bombed as well?
You know, that was the real challenge, I think, of this conflict, and as a reporter, just trying to get to the places where you thought you needed to be to write the stories, to cover what was happening. In the beginning, I found a driver. He was an interesting guy, Abu Hassan. He was a communist dentist, and he didn't have any patients at that time, so he was making a little money on the side by driving, and he stuck with me in those first few days. He was charging a pretty steep price. It was $500 a day. But he was willing to go to some of these places because, as you pointed out, it was kind of unnerving, this fear of being on the road, of being mistaken as a target or of being targeted as a journalist. And after a few days, I think he'd had enough, and then we tried to start driving more as convoys or with a few other cars as journalists. But like I said, I think that was the most unnerving part of the coverage. And I think, you know, the journalists down there did take quite a few risks in just trying to get around and trying to get to the places where the war is actually happening.
What were the biggest dangers and obstacles that you faced on the road?
You know, I think it was fear. I'm not sure how else to put it. I mean, you know, nothing happened, obviously, and you know, nothing really fell that close to me. But I think it's that fear that you try to grapple with. That, you know, at times, at least for me, it can be overwhelming, and you spend a lot of your time just trying to keep it under control. There's something very unnerving about this, dealing with something that you can't see, and that was what was going on. The Israeli surveillance aircraft were going all the time. It's kind of an insect-like drone or a sound. It's a buzzing, and then you often do hear the contrails of the jets as well, and at times helicopters. But you know, in doing interviews with people in the hospital or cars that were struck on the road, I'd always ask the question: Did you hear it before it happened? And people often said they had not heard anything. It just struck, and I think that was always in the back of your mind as you're driving around, is just not knowing when something's going to happen.
Were you in any of the Lebanese towns as Israelis warned the residents to evacuate?
You know, I was, and a lot of journalists were. I mean, I think a lot of the journalists who were down in Tyre, took the exact same risks that I did. There was one story that I was trying to cover. It was a town called Srifa, which is west of Tyre. And there had been a bombing there, an Israeli bombing, and there were reports of dozens of people buried under the wreckage, and no one could get there. The Red Cross couldn't get there. The government was pretty much non-existent at that point in southern Lebanon. And, you know, I thought it was a story that should be covered. And we tried to get there, this driver that I had, the dentist, and we made it, you know, quite a ways toward there. But then at the end, you just couldn't get in. There was too much shelling and bombing going on. And I remember we were stuck in we were looking at the town across the valley. And we were stuck in another town that I think had been ordered to be evacuated. And most of the people had sought cover in a villa that had been abandoned early on in the war. And it was one of those strange scenes, and I think you found this often in southern Lebanon, where you would walk into a village, and for all intents and purposes, it looked abandoned. I mean, there was nobody there. There were no cars in the streets. There were no people in the storefronts. There was maybe a few animals, dogs or cats, that were going through the streets. But once you spent more time in the village, you would see these signs of life kind of hiding, and this happened in this town that I was mentioning. I found one guy sitting on the side of the road, and you talked to him, and he said there's dozens of people, scores of people in a shelter, and I walked over to the shelter, and then there was this, I mean, basically a whole community that had sought refuge in the basement of a building for days. I mean, days basically in the dark. I mean, it was sunlight outside, obviously, but they were in a garage, effectively. And you know, when you walked into that shelter, they basically reorganized their lives. It was kind of remarkable to me how, you know, that resilience of people, how people can take the most unbelievably difficult situation and try to make something normal out of it. There was a rotation for cooking meals, of cleaning the place, of of taking out the trash, of filling the water. And I ended up spending several hours there, and I had planned on doing a story about what had happened in this town, Sedefa, with the bombing. And I ended up doing a story about, you know, how these people were trying to negotiate the war in the basement.
Why did they stay after they were warned by Israelis that their town would be bombed?
Well, I think a lot of people did leave. You know, they fled north, either to Sidon or to Beirut or to the mountains where they thought it was safe. You know, but a lot of people didn't have the means. I mean, drivers were charging up to $500 to go on the roads at that point. And people also, you know, I think there's a powerful sense, especially among people in southern Lebanon, the Shiites in southern Lebanon, who have fled in the past, where their land was occupied in the past. And the idea of abandoning their homes or leaving, I think it touches a very deep chord among some of those people. And often they did refuse. You know, to abandon their house was basically to abandon everything they had. Their house was basically their sole source of wealth or of property. And so you found, I think, in surprising numbers, people who refused to leave, and this was an example of it. They might have been in the bomb shelter, but at least they were close to their house, and they knew they would know what happened to their house. They would know what was still in their house. And that was an example of that town that I was in. People just had refused to leave. They weren't going to go to north, regardless of what happened around them.
You were in Qana after a house with two extended families was bombed. The families were taking shelter there, and most of the people there were killed, including a lot of children. What did you see there? When did you get there?
You know, I was in Beirut the night. I had gone to Beirut for the day to work on a story for the Washington Post Sunday paper, and then I was woken up the next morning and we'd heard that what had happened in Qana, so I got in the car and just went down there. And I guess I got there around 1 o'clock, and they were still pulling bodies out of the wreckage. You know, it wasn't a collapsed building. The shell had landed in front of the building, basically entombing the people. They were buried. And, you know, often when you go to these bomb scenes, or at least from my experience in Iraq, they're very grim scenes. I mean, they're very gory. You know, bodies don't stay intact when a bomb lands on them. But they had in this instance, because they were, as I said, they were buried by the dirt and the debris. And so when I was there, they pulled out a young boy. You know, his body was almost lifelike still. And I think the most disturbing scene of that was as they pulled him out, his pacifier was still attached to his shirt. And that face had that kind of lifelike quality. You know, there was dirt in his mouth, on his nose. But it was still a boy. And I think that, you know, those memories you take away from seeing like that, it was that pacifier that I found most disturbing, and that then when you think back to something like Qana, you have trouble getting out of your mind.
When you showed up in towns that had been bombed or were about to be bombed, did people ask you for help?
You know, that's something that's, and I mentioned this in a few stories. It was amazing, I guess, the degree to which journalists had become, I don't want to say part of the story, but I guess the degree to which journalists, you know, were within the story in a way. And like you said, almost every town I went to, people would ask, can you give me a ride out? People wouldn't ask for money. I mean, there's such a sense of dignity down there and pride that I think asking for money would demean them at a certain level. But asking for a ride out, that happened all the time. Some people were joking about it, you know, when you come back, can you give me a ride out? More often, people would shout from the road, we need to go to Beirut, we need to go to Sidon. And again, this comes back to the money issue, that people just didn't have the money to leave. There was a town that I was in, and the other journalists were in as well, called Bint Jebel. And the town square the center of the town is pretty much gone at this point. It's just rubble like I've never seen before, not in Fallujah, not in Jenin during 2003. I think it was me and a couple of other journalists had gone in with the Red Cross, and the ambulances couldn't get past a certain point because of the rubble. And we kept walking in. And again, it's that same sense of like, you see just, you know, a little bit of movement. And then the further you went in, people had been hiding in basements. I remember it struck me that the rubble was kind of blown up against the side of the house like a snowdrift in a way. And very old people came out. There was one woman that I actually ended up helping out, trying to help out to where the Red Cross was. She was 80 years old. Her back was parallel to the ground. And she wanted help, obviously, but it's a very conservative society. It's a very traditional place. And, you know, a young man touching a woman like that was not, you know, I couldn't help her out. It was uncomfortable to her. So I basically ended up trying to guide her, and she crawled over the rubble. and then she wouldn't go any further because her brother was still lost. And so she insisted that I try to go find her brother. I couldn't find her brother. And finally she was, you know, she was persuaded to leave. And incidentally, her brother was found later on, about 4 or 5 hours later. And they were reunited as they were taken out of Bint Jebel to another town called Timnin in the hospital there. But like, as you pointed out, it was this sense that, you know, there was nobody else there. The Red Cross was there, but they couldn't get in. The government was pretty much non-existent. Hezbollah does have a very, very organic relationship to these villages, and there were some activists there, Hezbollah activists that were helping people out. But as a journalist, you were in a place where the mechanisms of government or how government operates just didn't exist anymore, and these people were pretty much left to their own fate.
So when people asked you for help getting out of town, what did you do?
Well, I mean, we were working, and you know, it's always a struggle what you do in those situations. I mean, you are a journalist, you are a professional. You know, at the same time, you don't lose, you know, a certain decency. And you know, when you could help, you would help. I mean, from one town that I was in, we did give a ride to a couple of people who had been trapped in there and gave them a ride out to Tyre. Journalists did try to help when they could, the old people just trying to get out of their houses. But there's only so much you can do, and it is frustrating. You know, how do I put this? It does feel very bleak in those situations, and you do try to do what you can without maybe crossing the line of what you should do as a journalist. And often it's very little that you can do. I mean, like I said, they weren't looking for money. It was often just transportation. And I was riding in a small car, and there wasn't that much room in that car for other people. And you know, I guess you have to make those choices that you wouldn't want to make all the time.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Anthony Shadid. He's a Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post and just covered the war in Lebanon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anthony Shadid. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. He's covered the war in Baghdad. He just returned to the States from covering the war in Lebanon. Hezbollah apparently had stored a lot of rockets in people's homes. Did you have a sense of that living there?
You know, there was a lot of talk about this idea of Hezbollah using residents as shields, for instance, or firing from within homes or forcing people to stay. And I remember I was talking to a Human Rights Watch person about that. I have to be blunt about this, and I don't want to speak with authority on this because I don't know the full extent of how the fight was organized. But I didn't see people being used as shields. I didn't hear about an instance of that. It's always, I think, a difficult question when we talk about Hezbollah's relationship to southern Lebanon to divorce it too much from its environment. I mean, Hezbollah has, and I think I said this earlier, it has a very organic relationship to residents in southern Lebanon, and I think in particular to residents in southern Lebanon, and often to make a distinction between Hezbollah and the community in which it lives is very difficult. It's a deep relationship. It's a relationship that's been incubated over 2 decades. I saw this in a town called Khiem, for instance, at the very end of the war, when these people who had fought in the village almost within 24 hours had become relief workers. I saw the relationship between the residents and those people that were working inside the communities. It has a large degree of popular support, and I don't want to overstate it. I think there is criticism of Hezbollah among Shiites in Beirut, for instance. But when we talk about southern Lebanon, we talk about those villages that have been under Israeli occupation for almost 20 years. It is a very deep relationship, a relationship that does make it hard to sometimes maybe put one side or the other as distinct.
You know, I think when people accuse Hezbollah as using people as shields, that they don't mean that the people are tied up to the home that the weapons in, but rather by integrating the weapons into communities as organically as Hezbollah did, that you can't possibly attack the arsenal, you can't possibly try to wipe out the weapons without bombing residents and homes.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's no question that there was, you know, They were operating from within towns. They were operating among the people. I didn't see that happen in non-Shiite towns, in Christian towns or Druze towns, for instance. Mm-hmm. From talking to people there, that didn't happen within those towns. Within the Shiite towns, there's no question that that was happening. Now, I mean, it's a question to ask that's broader than, you know, than my purview as a journalist. You know, to what degree do you try to protect civilian life, even if those civilians are supporters of the movement? I don't know. I mean, a lot of civilians died in this conflict, more than 1,000. Well, it's difficult to say to what degree those attacks were targeting weapons and rather targeting the infrastructure of Hezbollah. And when we talk about the infrastructure of Hezbollah, we're talking about its popular support.
Did you have any direct contact with Hezbollah members, either the political or militia members of Hezbollah during the war?
Yeah, it's not, you know, Hezbollah has always been, has its reputation in Lebanon, especially before this fighting broke out, of being, you know, on one hand, they're a very shadowy presence, and on the other hand, they're a very visible presence. And I think that's one of the kind of, not contradiction necessarily, but that's one of the dynamics of the movement. Mm-hmm. You never see their fighters. I mean, before the war, you never saw their fighters with weapons in the streets, even in the towns like Bint Jebel, where they would have had most of their support. But as a social or political movement, they're very visible. They're quite open, even with journalists. It's not like dealing with the militants in Iraq, for instance. During the war, they did come out and have a more visible presence. You wouldn't necessarily see them with weapons, although you did come across them occasionally doing that. But it was clear who was a fighter and who wasn't. And you know, I did a story, I think maybe 2 weeks into the war, just talking to some of these guys. Hezbollah wasn't moving units, you know, for instance, from town to town or village to village. It was often the people inside the town where their supplies were already positioned. You know, they were the people from that town. And so you would come across them. And I think at the end of the war, they became even more visible. I remember I went to a town called Khiam, right next to the Israeli border, where and I had gone there, you know, expecting them to come out of hiding after the ceasefire had gone into effect, and they were there. They were in the streets. They were very visible. There wasn't any celebration going on or anything like that, but there was a certain confidence they had, and you could talk to them, and you could ask them about what happened. They're quite savvy. They know what to say and what not to say, and there is a pretty, and when I say savvy, it's not a judgment of them. They're sophisticated and quite disciplined, and they will only say so much. But again, in that town, Khiam, you saw that kind of, you saw the complexity of the movement, you know, in front of you, that fighters had turned into, for lack of a better phrase, had turned into relief workers within 24 hours, and the movement really mobilized in those 72 hours after the ceasefire went into effect.
I think a lot of people in the United States see it as paradoxical that Hezbollah, which instigated the war by kidnapping Israeli soldiers, later is the defender of the people in the war. So, like, they become the aid workers, but on the other hand, they committed the action that started the war. Mm. So I'm wondering if you see that as paradoxical.
And
if you think any people in Lebanon saw it as paradoxical.
I think it's a good question, when I'm describing the movement's complexity, the movement's sophistication, this isn't to sugarcoat the movement itself by any means. I mean, the opposite. This is a movement that was blamed for the bombing of the Marine barracks in 1983, for bombing the U.S. embassy twice during the Civil War in Lebanon. I think that's the perception of the movement abroad, and it is a movement of competing narratives. There's no question about that. It's a movement that's evolved since the early 80s. It occupies a much different place in Lebanon than maybe its perception abroad of how it operates. I think its perception abroad is as a terrorist organization. The United States government has declared it as such. In Lebanon, it's often a more, I don't want to say ambiguous, but a more nuanced portrayal of the movement, because it is a political organization at the same time as it's a militia, at the same time it's a social welfare organization. And in that, it represents a lot of what you've seen with Islamic politics in the rest of the region. When you say its perception in Lebanon, and let me be specific on this, you know, Lebanon is a very complicated country. It's a country of 18 religious sects. The Shiites in Lebanon are the plurality. And what you've seen over the past 20 years, I mean, or even longer than that, 30 years, is a certain arc of Shiite empowerment within Lebanon. But other communities, and, you know, sentiments will often shift across sectarian lines, but if you speak in the broadest terms and in the biggest generalizations, you do see a great degree of fear among Christians, among Sunnis, among Druze in Lebanon about the role of Hezbollah's arms, that in the country it's the only militia that still has its arms after other militias had disbanded with the end of the civil war in 1990. What I was struck by, I guess, as a reporter there, is that at the beginning of the war, the people who disliked Hezbollah and the people who liked Hezbollah, those sentiments really didn't change all that much. They maybe deepened, they maybe became exacerbated, but the lines, the fault lines within the society stayed relatively stable throughout the war. The people who were opposed to it remained opposed to it. The people who supported it remained supportive, even as the war progressed. And I think this is one of the problems you face as Lebanon looks forward to the future these months after the ceasefire, is that there are very clear, very deep differences over the organization itself, over how the war is portrayed, and over how the war will be remembered. Hezbollah sees this as a victory. It celebrates this, what it calls, in its propaganda that's been coming out since the end of the war, it's been calling it the divine victory. Not all Lebanese see it that way. They see that the country suffered incredibly, in the wake of this abduction of the two soldiers. At the same time, I think there's a lot of anger at Israel, that the abduction of two soldiers didn't merit the dismantling of Lebanon's infrastructure and this the degree of civilian deaths that happened during the war. It is a complicated picture right now, and I don't think, my sense of it, I just left yesterday, is that Lebanese don't know exactly how to remember the war at this point, and I think there is going to be a certain soul-searching in the months ahead.
Anthony Shadid is a Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university committed to delivering academic excellence online at capella.edu. From Bob and Mary Montgomery, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Anthony Shadid about covering the war in Lebanon for The Washington Post. And John Powers reviews the new DVD edition of the 1944 film noir classic, Double Indemnity. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Anthony Shadid, a Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the war in Iraq. We're talking about his coverage of the war in Lebanon. You write in an article from July 30th that in public many of the leaders of Lebanon's factions struck a united front in the face of Israeli attacks, but in private, many had hoped the conflict would force Hezbollah's disarmament. Can you talk a little bit about the difference you saw between the public and the private face of certain political leaders?
You know, you felt, I think, even during the war, that people were jockeying for their positions after the war. And so, you know, for any leader, regardless of their political affiliation or sectarian affiliation to somehow be supportive or to even be neutral as Israel was attacking Lebanon, you know, that's not, you can't sustain that. It would be a mistake because people would remember what was said after the war. People would remember what was said during the war. And so people, I was struck by the degree to which there was protest or trying to keep a united front within Lebanese politics as the war progressed. But it was clear within 2 or 3 days after the ceasefire, people were saying different things. And I think we're going to see much more different things said in the weeks and months ahead. Hezbollah's arms is one of the central issues in front of Lebanese politics today. Some people accuse Hezbollah of abducting these soldiers as a way of aborting that conversation or aborting that dialogue that was going on about its arms. It's not been resolved. I mean, I think what we're dealing with right now in Lebanon is, to a certain degree, the status quo we had before the war. Hezbollah is still armed. There's a UN force that's always been in southern Lebanon. It may increase in its numbers, but the contradictions or the tensions that exist in Lebanese politics are still there. And if anything, they're exacerbated. And, you know, some might argue that Hezbollah has even a stronger position within Lebanese politics now than it did before the war. You know, how this is going to be resolved, I don't know. And I don't think a lot of Lebanese know either. And I think that's why so many Lebanese are pessimistic or discouraged about the future. You know, when I got back to Beirut after the ceasefire, it struck me that every conversation I had, not one person was hopeful. And not only not hopeful, I mean, they were bleak about what was ahead. You know, people talk about civil war. Lebanese often talk about civil war, and I don't think people necessarily feel that a civil war is going to erupt again, but they do look at this issue of Hezbollah's arms, and they don't see how it can be resolved peacefully.
Well, did you get the feeling that a lot of leaders of other political and ethnic groups in Lebanon really want Hezbollah to disarm so that Hezbollah can't unilaterally decide when there's going to be a war, the way it kind of did this time around?
Right. I think that's a huge issue, is that, you know, that there is that perception that Hezbollah chose the time and the place for to act. Now, I don't think, in talking to Hezbollah people, I don't think they expected what happened to happen. I think they expected 2 or 3 days of retaliation and that it would go back to what it was. I mean, instead we got more than a month of the most, you know, the most devastating attack on Lebanon since the Civil War. And there have been some promises, some assurances made within the Lebanese cabinet over Hezbollah acting unilaterally again. Whether those promises or assurances, I mean, I think they're verbal. Whether they'll be held to is a question, you know, for the future. And again, I guess I should point out that even within Lebanese politics, you have alliances going on, alliances that cross sectarian lines. One of the most popular Christian leaders, Michel Aoun, has a certain alliance with Hezbollah, and that alliance wasn't broken even during the war. And so you do see these, you know, you do see alliances that cross sectarian lines that make it even more complicated than it might have been, say, 3 or 4 years ago. It'll be interesting to see how those alliances hold together, or whether they change or whether they shift in the months ahead. But right now, for instance, you do have this alliance between Hezbollah and a certain section of the Christian community. You have an exacerbation of tension between Sunni Muslims and Shiite Muslims in Lebanon. You know, I think it's not too much to say that the basic political contract that was at the center of Lebanon's creation of a country, of Lebanon's independence in the 1940s, is not as relevant today, if relevant at all. I mean, it was a contract between Maronite Catholics and Sunni Muslims, the two key constituencies inside Lebanon. But what we're dealing with these days in Lebanon is a notion of Shiite empowerment or Shiite politicization. You know, the coming of age of a community that was incredibly deprived, almost ignored throughout Lebanon's early years, and today is the most pivotal or decisive community in the country today. And it's a community that didn't have a hand in that, in the founding of the country, in that original political contract. And I think a sense of a lot of Lebanese is that contract is being renegotiated. It's being redefined. How it's negotiated, how it's defined is the question, you know, for the future. But what we're dealing with is a gradual but decisive transformation of Lebanese politics.
The Lebanese army is supposed to be helping to keep peace in the south of Lebanon. It's unclear to me whether they're supposed to be ensuring that Hezbollah disarms. What's your understanding of the role that the Lebanese army is supposed to be playing now?
basically the role. And I mean, this was the agreement that was struck to deploy the army in southern Lebanon. Is they're going to look the other way. If Hezbollah carries arms in the streets, that would be an issue. And I think in that situation, they would have that they're going to be the only armed presence, visible armed presence in the south. But that was never the issue with Hezbollah. They never did carry their arms in the streets. It was antithesis almost. I mean, they even people within these villages where they had the greatest support would say they never saw Hezbollah carrying arms in the towns themselves. So what we're dealing with is the status quo to a certain degree, that, you know, Hezbollah will be discreet. The army, it always had a token presence in the south, and there was always a UN force in the south, and they were the only ones with arms in the streets, but they didn't do anything, you know, about Hezbollah's weapons caches, for instance, or their arsenal of rockets. These things were hidden, and as long as they're, you know, our understanding of what the agreement was, that as long as they're hidden, nothing's going to be done about them.
What is the Lebanese army? Like, who's in it? Are all the different ethnic and religious groups in Lebanon represented in the army? Is the army trusted by the population of Lebanon?
The army, you know, during the Civil War, the army splintered rather quickly, and it wasn't much of a force throughout the Civil War years of 1975 to 1990. I think after 1990, the military was seen as a certain source of pride, that here was an institution that represented the state. And I think most Lebanese want a stronger state. You know, the failure of the state was one of the causes of the Civil War itself. There was a certain degree, I think, of resentment, mainly among Shia, that the army played no role in the fighting that happened this past month. It did stand by even after it was attacked by Israeli forces. And there was actually a general who was a police general who was arrested recently for. He was in the barracks that the Israelis took over in a town called Marjayoun, and there was film. They had filmed him serving tea to the Israelis, smiling, chatting casually, and after that footage came out, he was arrested by Lebanese authorities. So I think there was a degree of resentment about that. I think other people saw that the Lebanese army stood no chance if it did enter into the war itself. When we look forward to what's going to happen, I mean, Does anyone expect the Lebanese army can actually disarm Hezbollah? I don't think people do expect that. Do they want the Lebanese army there? They do. I mean, the Lebanese army is a symbol of the state, and the idea of the state taking control over all Lebanese land, I think, is an important notion to most people. But it's just I don't think it's perceived as a force that's all that capable. It's, you know, they're driving armored personnel carriers that are a generation old. You know, they have guns, but beyond that, not all that much. I think when you look at martial prowess or whatever, I think most Lebanese would clearly see Hezbollah as being the more formidable force.
Hezbollah right now is offering money and help to people whose homes were bombed during the war. And this is another reason why Hezbollah is becoming very heroic in the eyes of many people in Lebanon. What can you tell us about the money that they're using to do this? How much of it comes from Iran? And, you know, what you know about their plan to help rebuild?
I mean, what I had heard even before the war ended, that and this came from, you know, from someone who did know very well what was going on within the organization, was that I think it was anywhere from $120 million to $150 million had arrived from Iran even before the war was over. You know, Hezbollah says the Israelis receive American money and American weapons. What's wrong with us receiving Iranian money and Iranian weapons? That's their defense of it. There's no question that they did receive. I mean, the lion's share of their budget does come from Iran, and they were on there. I think Hezbollah had put a great deal of pressure on itself to provide immediate relief, knowing that the toll that its constituency had suffered. Its constituency is everything to it. If it loses that connection to its constituency, it stops being a relevant power in Lebanon. And providing relief was, I mean, Nasrallah talked about it within, I think, 24 hours of the ceasefire, that we are going to help. And they did. There was, you know, in some parts of southern Beirut, which were devastated by the Israeli attacks, they were handing out $12,000 to families. They had promised to pay for rent up to a year as houses were rebuilt. They had promised to buy furniture. When I was in Khiam, within 24 hours after the ceasefire had ended, a committee had been formed that was surveying the damage of each house, not only in the town itself, but in the villages that surrounded it. Bulldozers were taking away the wreckage. Trucks of food and water were plying the streets in Khiam, for instance. This is Hezbollah. This is not the government that's doing it. The government was very upset that Hezbollah had taken the initiative and that was doing it without its coordination or its approval. But I think, again, like I said, Hezbollah is dealing with two or dealing with a very immediate need, and that it has to show that it can care for its own community. That's where its support is. That's where its strength is. And it did act, and I think it showed its. I mean, we were talking about an extremely well organized movement, a movement that in a Lebanese context again has a reputation for being uncorrupt, has a reputation for being disciplined, and has a reputation for being very effective. That they do what they say. And I think we saw that on display in those few days after the ceasefire.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Anthony Shadid. He's a Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post and covered the war in Lebanon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anthony Shadid. He's a Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Iraq War. He just returned to the States from covering the war in Lebanon. I want to quote something that you co-wrote in an article in The Post in September of 2002. And this article was headlined, "Iraq War Hawks Have Plans to Reshape Entire Mideast." And this was about how the Bush administration thought that going to war in Iraq would reshape the Middle East and make the region safer for Israel. The person who you described as the most vocal hawk at the State Department was John Bolton, who is, of course, now the ambassador to the UN and helped negotiate the ceasefire in Lebanon. So I guess what goes through your mind when you watch the person who was the most vocal hawk in the State Department about going to war in Iraq, thinking it would bring peace to the Middle East, now being the person who had to deal with the war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon?
You know, I think when we talk about, the easiest way to answer that question would be to look just across the region right now and the sense in the region right now. And it's a very dejected moment, I think, in much of the Middle East. But not to be flip about this, but part of me feels like, you know, locking the doors and heading for cover about what's ahead. It's a region that is dramatically different than the one that I first started covering in 1995 when I was based in Cairo. It's a region that's far angrier. It's a region that you have kind of a sense that there's a lot going on under the surface that you're not fully aware of and fully conscious of. And I think, you know, people in the Middle East themselves are unsettled. It's too light of a word, and I'm not sure what the stronger word is, but you know, there's a sense that we haven't seen the repercussions of the Iraq war in the rest of the region. There's a sense of anger, I think, in the Arab world that the United States gave Israel a green light to continue the war as long as it did. You know, I'm always struck by when you look back at these kind of pivotal events in the Middle East, you see repercussions that were, or consequences that were unintended. The Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982 led directly to the creation of Hezbollah. The Gulf War in 1990 was one of the factors that led to the ascent of Osama bin Laden. You know, what are the repercussions of this war going to be? I don't know. Perhaps there won't be any. It's hard to say at this point. But you do feel, and I noticed this reporting in some of the cities in Lebanon before the war actually erupted, that we are starting to see something that might be taking shape. There is a certain radicalization among Sunni Muslims. There is a remarkable degree of empowerment among Shiites, not only in Lebanon but elsewhere. You know, how does the dust settle from these events that are seismic in a way, that are pivotal? It's hard to say, but I think there is a sense across the region that while there was some optimism about the intentions of U.S. policy early on, not across the board by any means, but there was some optimism, especially among secular liberals in the Middle East, that we might see a region that was somehow transformed. I think what you see today is a much different picture than it was a year ago. And I think across the board right now, there's fear, there's anxiety, there's unease about what the repercussions of U.S. policy in the region are going to be.
In 2001, you wrote a book called Legacy of the Prophet, Despots, Democrats, and the New Politics of Islam. It was a very optimistic book, and you wrote that the popular model of Islam is as a threatening, monolithic force, one that specializes in bombings and kidnappings and that lurks behind the world's turmoil. But that image is being made obsolete by a new generation of Islamic activists who, from the slums of Beirut to the warrens of Cairo, are embracing democratic politics and grassroots activism. And you wrote their agendas revolve around social services, civil society, and most importantly, a growing willingness to work within systems that they once opposed, sometimes violently. And you offered Lebanon as an example of these new politics and offered Hezbollah as a movement that perhaps best encapsulated what you were talking about. Do you still have that optimism about young Muslims and about groups like Hezbollah?
You know, I have to be honest, I'm a little more pessimistic right now about what's ahead in the region. I think what we've seen since 2001, I think that trend that I saw in Legacy of the Prophet is still very clearly there. And I think you see it in particular with the Muslim Brotherhood in countries like Egypt, for instance, or even Jordan. You do see Hezbollah as a political actor. You know, its arms remain a huge impediment to its full integration into Lebanese politics, but it is there as a political movement. I think what you do see is these terms are always, you know, kind of hard to define, moderate, radical, whatever. But I think what you do see among some of these moderate Islamic activists in the Brotherhood, for instance, or elsewhere, is encouraging. You know, obviously the United States is very wary, or the U.S. government, I should say, is very wary about what these movements mean and what their intentions are. But within the societies themselves, they are less threatening than they used to be. And I speak here about Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood did well in the Egyptian elections. Could it be integrated as a political force that would make a more healthy kind of polity within Egypt? I think that's very possible. But you're also dealing with these other currents that are much more radical. You're dealing with currents that are coming out of Iraq. You're dealing with a potential radicalization that comes out of this war in Lebanon. You're dealing with the bin Laden phenomenon. You know, my sense is just as a reporter in the region, and not as a specialist, not as an academic, but as a reporter, is that these two currents are coexisting side by side right now. There's a certain current within Islamic politics that does want to embrace a notion of pluralism, that does want to acknowledge the political system as it exists and wants to participate within it. And you're also seeing, you know, for lack of a better word, another current that embraces a certain nihilism. And that seeing it somehow integrated into politics or into a political system is very, very difficult to imagine. You know, my hope is that the first wins out. My sense right now is that it's perhaps the latter that has the stronger hand.
You're an American of Lebanese descent. Do you still have family in Lebanon?
I do have cousins in a town called Marjayoun, which is in southern Lebanon, near the Israeli border. Most of them left to Beirut during the war itself, and others have left, you know, earlier during the Civil War. They had actually moved north to Beirut.
Are you going to continue living in Beirut?
You know, it's a difficult question, I guess, to answer. It's been a pretty tumultuous few years, and I'm not. I don't really like the notion of being a war correspondent or something along those lines. I don't find it all that interesting to cover in some ways. I think if you treat war as a backdrop to what happens in people's lives, you can do journalism that is meaningful and that is relevant. But war itself, it doesn't, holds very little attraction to me. And it does kind of take its toll, and you get tired of it. The idea of covering a civil war in Lebanon is not appealing. And, you know, again, probably an exaggeration that a civil war might erupt. But I was enjoying writing stories about streets in Lebanon and profiles and the kind of quiet side to the Arab world before this war erupted. And I'm not sure that I want to keep covering this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I should say that when you've been interested in covering the Middle East since you were a teenager, and your intention, I guess, wasn't to be a war correspondent as much as to just cover the Middle East, but more and more that seems to mean being a war correspondent.
Yeah, that's right. In the Middle East these days, I mean, you know, the Iraq war and now this war. And as I said, you know, it's a region that in some ways that is hard to recognize today compared to when I first got here 10 years ago. It's a region that's gone through upheavals, to say the least. And you know, like I said earlier, the dust hasn't settled. These upheavals are still going on. And when you talk to people, you kind of take on some of the things that people are saying, you know, your own outlook and your own perspective on it. And there is a lot of dejection out there right now. There is a lot of anxiety. And I guess that's the best way to put it.
Well, Anthony Shadid, thanks for talking with us, and be safe, be well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid is a Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. Coming up, our critic-at-large John Powers reviews a new DVD edition of a 1944 film he considers a perfect example of film noir. This is Fresh Air. Dozens and dozens of film noir from the 30s and 40s are now on DVD. Our critic-at-large John Powers has piles of them, but he says one stands out. It's the new digitally remastered Double Indemnity. John says it's the best example of the enduring power of film noir.
Although I like to take pride in my sunny nature, I must confess that no movie pulls me in like a film noir. And to judge from the explosion of noir DVDs, I'm not alone. More than half a century after its heyday, millions of us are still held rapt by its trademark sense of dislocation. All those mean streets, femme fatales, and ordinary Joes who get sucked into a whirlpool of doom. There may be no more perfectly tooled expression of the genre than Double Indemnity, the 1944 tale of murder just released in a fine new DVD. Not only is its story quintessential noir, so are its origins. From the beginning, film noir was a cultural hybrid, a cross between American pulp and a German film style brought to Hollywood by émigrés fleeing fascism. In Double Indemnity, this cultural exchange is writ large. Based on a potboiler by James M. Cain, the film was partly scripted by Raymond Chandler and directed by Austrian-born Billy Wilder. Fred McMurray stars as Walter Neff, an insurance agent who narrates the story to his friend Barton Keyes. That's Edward G. Robinson, a crack claims inspector at the same company. The tale is simple. Hoping to renew a client's policy, Neff meets Phyllis Dietrichson, a sneering man-trap played by perhaps the most worldly and independent actress in Hollywood history, Barbara Stanwyck. Phyllis isn't shy about flashing her legs or swapping tawdry banter, and Neff quickly falls under her spell. But he has some doubts, as in this scene, when he grasps that Phyllis wants to ensure her husband's life, without him knowing it.
Goodbye, Mr. Dietrichson.
What's the matter?
Look, baby, you can't get away with it. You want to knock him off, don't you?
That's a horrible thing to say.
What do you think I was, anyway? A guy that walks into a good-looking dame's front parlor and says, good afternoon, I sell accident insurance on husbands? You got one that's been around too long, one you'd like to turn into a little hard cash? Just give me a smile and I'll help you collect? Boy, what a dope you must think I am.
I think you're rotten.
I think you're swell. So long as I'm not your husband.
Get out of here.
You bet I'll get out of here, baby. I'll get out of here, but quick.
Neff may talk tough, but he's hooked. And within minutes, he's plotting Mr. Dietrichson's accidental murder. Naturally, the whole scheme goes terribly wrong. And this going wrong is precisely what draws us to Neff's story. For like nearly all film noir, it offers a pop version of classical tragedy, in which a modern hero, a regular guy who tries to escape the little narrowness of daily life, winds up unleashing the very fates that will destroy him. Now, it's easy to see how such a vision of life could have emerged in the 30s and 40s, when most ordinary Americans felt caught in the undertow of huge impersonal forces. The Great Depression, the threat of Nazism and communism, even the unsettling shift in gender roles as women poured into the workforce during World War II. In such a context, it was natural that many men felt overwhelmed, powerless, and like Walter Neff, yearned to escape. It was equally natural that noir should begin to fade during the 1950s boom years, when men felt more in control of their lives. and women were sent back to work in their spanking new kitchens. There were some great noir movies in that decade, of course, like Kiss Me Deadly and Vertigo. But noir soon fell into mannered decadence. Without the profound feelings of social paranoia that inspired it, the genre became little more than just a collection of stylistic tics. Yet even as time ran out on Hollywood's ability to make film noir, the great old noir films began to feel increasingly timeless. This is partly because the visual style of classic noir is so hauntingly beautiful. All that glorious black and white photography, all those thrillingly dark shadows. And it's partly because noir plays on our culture's continuing uneasy fascination with powerful women. Noir heroines tend to be smart, sexy, and lethal. And there's a lot of terrified misogyny in this. The term black widow comes to mind. But there's also something thrilling about seeing such forceful women in a movie era when Meryl Streep's Miranda Priestly in The Devil Wears Prada is the year's only female role to approach the potent vividness of Stanwyck's Phyllis Dietrichson. But the big reason for its enduring power is this. Unlike westerns, costume dramas, or romantic comedies, the great noir films put us in touch with the power of darkness, be it the death-entranced corners of our psyche or the shadowy flip side of our American obsession with success. Noir comes steeped in failure and ruin, and it does so without making these things dreary. It invests its small-time heroes and heroines with a sense of awful grandeur. After all, in Double Indemnity, Walter Neff doesn't merely ruin his life for a woman. He turns his ruination into a larger-than-life story that still grips us 60 years later.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Therapy is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. From Rosalind Croman Swig, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the war in Lebanon has affected prospects for a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. We'll hear from two longtime proponents of a two-state solution. Israeli Yossi Beilon is a member of the Knesset. Palestinian Sari Nusebe is president of Al-Quds University in East Jerusalem. Join us for the next Fresh Air.